For program information, audio, video and more, head to the RN homepage.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Tonight, sex and its place in our culture. When does eroticism become pornography? What's a turn-on and what's a turn-off in literary depictions of sex? And why are so many of us apparently so interested in watching or reading about sex? It's the most private of acts between two people, yet we are surrounded in the modern world by overtly sexualized imagery and behaviour. A sea of online pornography is a simple click away, and our popular culture is, for better or worse, awash with sex. Witness the vastly successful 50 Shades of Grey that's recently been doing the rounds at the suburban multiplexes. 50 Shades is based on the book franchise of the same name, and during its opening weekend, it raked in $250 million worldwide. In Britain, it made more money than any previous 18 certificate movie. And the blockbuster book trilogy that started it all? Well, despite being derided by critics, it has sold 100 million copies. At one stage, a copy of the book was being sold somewhere in the world every second. What does this tell us? Does this suggest a curiosity with transgressive sexual practices like S&M? Tonight, Big Ideas is talking with a writer of sex and a scholar of sex. Yes, the latter does exist. This is a fairly forthright discussion about sex, sexual behaviour, and its portrayal in literature and pornography, which makes it an adult conversation. So if you think you might find it offensive, or if you don't want the kids to hear it, then you should probably turn off the radio for the next hour or so. Chrissy Neen is a writer and award-winning poet. She's been shortlisted for the Queensland Premier's Literary Awards. Her books include Affection, Steeplechase, Triptych, and soon to be published, Holly White and the Incredible Sex Machine. And Naomi Stekelenburg is a writer of erotic and pornographic fiction and an academic who just days ago submitted her PhD thesis on Marquis de Sade. They joined me recently at the Avid Reader bookstore in Brisbane. The first thing I noticed was that both of you have referred to your writing as pornographic as distinct from erotic. So I thought we'd start with this point of distinction in definitions. What is the difference between pornography and erotica? When does one cross over to become the other?
It does vary from generation to generation. What is considered pornographic for one generation is no longer pornographic for a generation to come. But personally, I work under the idea that in erotic fiction, there is sex involved, but it's sex in the context of love. In pornography, the love is definitely not foregrounded. It's a background. The sex is foregrounded in pornography. So it really is a very subtle and fine distinction. And it's different from person to person as to what one person finds pornographic and one person finds erotic. But for me, I always think about foregrounding the sexuality and the sex above the characters, the setting and the love in the work when I'm writing a piece of pornography. And when I'm writing a piece of erotica, because I do have written stuff that has an erotic edge rather than a pornographic edge, I consider the sex to be secondary in those pieces of writing. So my focus is always on the characters, the setting, the story, and the sex is a byproduct of that. So it's very, very subtle, and of course that will change. So if someone has never come across sex in literature before and reads a sexual passage, that will be foregrounded for them because that's what they're seeing that leaps off the page. So Lady Chatterley's Lover, for instance, was considered a work of pornography when it was first published in 1929. And yet today we would read that and say that it's erotic, but not pornographic. So that has changed in the eyes of the reader. So that's it's a movable feast.
Yeah.
But I always have to think sex, sex, sex when I think when I think pornography, and when I'm looking at erotica, it's the sex is less.
Do you agree, Naomi? Because I sort of saw it. The distinction really was for me that erotica implied a sort of artfulness, in sexual depiction that pornography perhaps didn't have, that pornography was had more distasteful connotations, perhaps.
I'm not sure the distinction is at all useful anyway. I mean, because there's so much slippage. Even Chrissy was talking about how it can vary from individual to individual, or from culture to culture. So I tend to just think about it as sex writing and representations of really extreme forms of human consciousness. And sexuality tends to fall into that category. So I try not to make the distinction because I think it's a false distinction and one that isn't solid and fixed.
I think there's certainly an understanding in the community that I think that when we think of pornography, the first thing that people think about is visual representations. They don't think of literature, first off. And I think that the reason that I think of literature is because that's where my base is and that's where I started from. But I think when you mention the word pornography, there's certainly a knee-jerk reaction to think, oh, we're talking about videos of people having sex on the internet. And that's not exactly true when you look at the actual dictionary definition of pornography, but there certainly is a knee-jerk reaction to the word, that's for sure.
Just in terms of that, I suppose, idea that people have of pornography being, as you say, videos of sex on the internet, and it is everywhere. The proliferation of pornography in modern society is astonishing. It's easily accessible to anyone, any age, click of the mouse. And, of course, you have a discussion going on around pornography now in society, suggesting essentially that it's warping attitudes towards sex and sexual behaviour. It's objectifying women in particular. But when you talk about pornography, the type of pornography that you're talking about is pornography, what, for women, by women? Is that how you imagine your writing?
No, not always. Actually, I don't think that the readership of my pornographic writing is specifically women, although there are a lot of women who read my work. So it's definitely by a woman, because I am one, but it's not necessarily for women, and it certainly has a broader appeal than that. I know a lot of men enjoy it. I think that the idea of differentiating between what women consume and what men consume is problematic at best, because we know that women consume the same kinds of pornography, even in terms of internet-based pornography, that men consume. It might not be in quite the same numbers, but there was I was reading a figure yesterday that was something like 70% of women consume at some stage or another, you know, video pornography on the internet, and it's something like 95% of men. So it's quite it's a bit higher with men, but certainly
it's
a large overlap.
That's surprising. Were you surprised when you read that or not?
No, I wasn't. I think that there's a cultural stigma behind, you know, watching pornography, and so therefore a lot of women don't necessarily admit it publicly. There's not that public discussion about women's consumption of pornography, but it's certainly amongst, you know, my social group, people talk about it, and people all do watch it from time to time. Everyone's selective about what kind of pornography they either read or they watch, but it's certainly quite a common thing to
Naomi, do you see pornography as being gendered? Male porn, female porn? What excites women is essentially different to what excites men, or not?
Yeah, though there is an attempt to make female-friendly porn, isn't there? And usually the distinction is about the bodies of the men. If you watch kind of porn that isn't specifically for women, the men's bodies are usually pretty gross and out of shape, and we don't see any faces, and no facial expressions, and no eye contact. Where the difference with female-friendly porn is that the men are usually pretty hot, and we get to see their faces and we get to see their emotion, and all of those things are represented.
And the objective of pornography, is it any different for women than it is for men? I mean, is it essentially about titillation in the way that conventional video pornography is, or are you imagining another purpose?
We go to pornography to imagine what if, don't we? What if I did that? What would it feel like? Would I be okay with that?
I think that, you know, men, women, whatever, other gender, we all have sexual fantasies. That's something that's common amongst people. And those fantasies are what feed our sex life, because, you know, we're in a situation where we're in a society that is predominantly suggesting that we should be monogamous. And when we're monogamous and we're the one partner for a number of years, that's going to get incredibly boring incredibly quickly for both parties. And the research that's being done at the moment is saying that it's actually going to get boring for women more quickly than it is for men, because women tend to tire of the same partner quicker than men, which is surprising research that is being done at the moment. But I do think that the idea that our fantasies can be presented to us in some kind of an art form keeps everything fresh, and certainly keeps our sexuality fresh, and certainly allows us to be playful with it in some ways. And there certainly is pornography, particularly, you know, video pornography, that is harmful in a lot of ways. But one, that it's created in a situation where the performers of the pornography are not treated well or paid, you know, award rates, and that's because it's illegal to create.
That's absolutely the case, and the objectification of women is absolutely prevalent as well. But it's interesting that the discourse around pornography is almost 100% based on that notion, and not on the more positive notion of pornography as a way to trigger the imagination, mm-hmm. or to trigger possibilities. I mean, pornography is just reeks of moral panic in the way it's spoken of in society, doesn't
it? Absolutely. We don't celebrate porn at all.
No, which is why literary pornography is such a useful tool, because no people are harmed in the creation of literary pornography. By definition, there are no actors in this particular kind of form. And so, you know, you can free yourself to explore areas that if you're exploring in other, you know, in video pornography, you wouldn't be able to do it because it would be harmful. And you can free yourself to be as explorative as you want to when you're writing literature, which is a wonderful freeing form. And yeah, so it's absolutely fantastic for that.
You're holding one of your books, Triptych, in your hand there. It was published by the highly reputable Text Publishing in Melbourne, but it was, in fact, and is, in fact, banned on certain e-book platforms.
It
banned because it is indeed pornographic?
It is, yeah, it is. It's banned because of there's three novellas in the book, and the middle novella is a novella which looks at, it's a book that looks at transgressive sexuality, and so the first novella looks at the transgression through internet-based pornography. The second novella looks at bestiality, and that's what got it banned. The third novella looks at a brother and sister who are living as a husband and wife and have been for many years, and they are tired of their relationship and have to rediscover their transgression to be able to be interested in sex again, which I found really fascinating to explore. But it was the bestiality that got it banned, because there's, you know, a blanket rule that you cannot depict bestiality on particular platforms. And so Apple iBooks banned it, and so did Google Play.
So incest was okay, but bestiality wasn't okay.
Absolutely. Somehow that kind of, and it's, you know, no animals are harmed in the creation of this work. It is a purely intellectual exercise to look at the ethics of pornography. This whole book is about the ethics of pornography, and so that middle novella is looking at if in the context of literary fiction you can suggest that an animal is a consenting partner in that fantasy world, it should be okay then to have sex with that animal if both partners are consenting and it's not harming either party. So that was what I was exploring in that novella, and yet the very idea that there was an animal and a human having sex made it banned. Very
so Naomi, do we and should we place limits on how far we should allow our imagination and our fantasies to take us if they take us into places that some people think are unsafe or overly dark? How do you limit the way we can construct these fantasies?
I think our bodies limit what we allow ourselves to think about. And that's part of what my research is about. Mm. So there's this idea that in literature you can imagine anything and you can conjure things that you could never do in real life. But I think in actual fact, our bodies have a stop point, and that stop point is usually with disgust. And so as soon as disgust is evoked, we turn away, we avoid the thing that's disgusting, whether it's an object or a thought. So I don't think we have to necessarily apply limits, because I think they're inherent, they're there.
So the conversation we're having now rarely occurs outside of perhaps the group of people that are here tonight who do have this conversation, but it doesn't occur very often on the media, doesn't occur very often on radio. There is clearly some form of cultural taboo about talking about, writing about sexual transgression in particular. It seems to me what people do in the privacy of their own home, providing it's consensual, that's okay, but talking about it, writing about it, that's starting to get into dangerous territory. Why do we need to talk about it? Why should we talk about this stuff? Why is it important?
Because it gives us insights into not only how we do sex, but how we organise our societies, how we are as human beings psychically. So I think that sex goes beyond the physical act of sex. It is a product of, and it reflects, a whole bunch of other stuff as well. Mm. And as soon as it's silenced, all of that other stuff is silenced also. And that's a point of, I think, danger.
Chrissy, why do you think it's important that we have these types of conversations?
Look, it's a really, really powerful thing. I actually think that talking and discussing sex is kind of a form of power. I do a lot of readings in public, and when I do a reading in public, if I'm reading a particularly erotic part of the work, you can actually physically see a change to the audience in the room. They're coming to the work not just with their head, but they are also physically, bodily brought into the moment of listening to the pornographic expression. So it's this point where the body and the mind are at one. We're so used to kind of, you know, leading with our head and leading with our intellect. And yet, you know, we completely ignore the physicality of a human being. And I think that writing and talking about pornographic expression brings our bodies into the conversation. Mm. And doing that, it kind of opens people to new ideas. So when you're aroused, it's just that it arouses you, which means that you are awake, alert, listening, thinking, ready. Mm. And that's when you can slip those, you know, thought bombs in. That's when, that's when you can actually make an impact with your work. Mm. So I use my writing as a weapon, and I use it as a weapon for social change. I don't necessarily know exactly how I want the society to change, but for me at the moment it's about testing and seeing how I can, what's the delivery device for that. So I'm really exploring the device to deliver ideas and how to change people's thoughts through literature.
So it's sexual writing as allegory, in a way, or as metaphor for bigger things that are at play, in a sense, and bigger possibilities, perhaps.
It's sexual writing that is a way of preparing people for bigger ideas, I suppose. It kind of opens people to the, you know, as soon as people are aroused by something that disturbs them, they're in flight or fight mode. You know, they kind of are alert and ready to go, like ready to either flee from the situation or to face it and confront it. And that's what sex writing does. It puts people into that position where they're unsettled and therefore they're ready to engage in some way and make decisions about things. Like at the moment, you know, my work is about exploration, the delivery. The drug of delivery is the sex writing. And, you know, one day when I figure out exactly how I want to change it, I'll throw that dart into the room.
But arousal is interesting too, isn't it? Because it's pleasurable. Mm. So maybe there's something in that. Maybe just the pure pleasure of reading something and being titillated is enough. Why can't we give ourselves permission to be aroused? Why can't we sit in that moment of, you know, corporeal excitement and just go, oh, this is cool. Mm. I like this.
And that's what it means to you, really?
Yeah, I think that's where we start to kind of celebrate sexuality and we take joy from it. It's in that pleasure of the arousal and
the moment.
Yeah, the moment. I mean, nothing brings us more into the moment than sex, does it?
I mean, do you think in a sense we're trying to create some higher purpose out of something that just exists in the moment, that should be enjoyed in the
moment?
Maybe
it just feels good.
That was Naomi Stekelenburg, writer of erotic and pornographic fiction, who teaches literature and creative writing. And Chrissy Neen, writer and award-winning poet. This is Big Ideas on RN, online and on your pod. Tonight we're discussing sex, erotica and pornography and 50 Shades of Grey, the phenomenally successful book trilogy and now movie. Is 50 Shades simply a fleeting pop culture phenomenon, or has it sparked a genuine interest in unconventional sexual practices? Naomi Stekelenburg.
I think it appeals to readers because it emphasises the female pleasure. And so when we read Anastasia and we imagine being her, we get a type of pleasure from that. I think that's at the core of it. Mm. We get a pleasure from imagining being swept away by this gazillionaire and
having sex with him. So the pleasure that you're getting is not much different from the minor pleasures one gets reading a pulp romance, reading a Mills and Boone in a way? Or
there's a different pleasure. The pleasure that you get from this book, or pleasure that a lot of people get from this book, is to actually read it publicly. Like, the thing with 50 Shades of Grey is the fact that women in their gazillions took the book to the buses, to the trams, to the trains, and proudly held their copy of the book up high and read it. Now, the absolute, incredible, undeniable power of that is that here are women, often past menopausal age, reading obviously what is considered pornographic material publicly, and they are saying with their copy of 50 Shades, I am a sexual person, I am a sexual being, and you need to take me seriously as a sexual being. I have other ideas about whether the book is good literature or not, which is you know, a completely different issue, but I think the actual power of that book, past a certain point, I think that at the beginning of its life, it was just that a lot of people liked the Twilight series, and it was fan fiction for as Masters of the Universe, as it was first published on the internet, it was fan fiction for Twilight. So there was a lot of Twilight readers that were frustrated because Bella and Edward never got it on. and so they're drawn to this ebook because Bella and Edward get it on. So when she pulls the ebook, changes it to Anastasia and Christian, and takes all the vampire stuff out of it and presents it as her own book, it already came with a whole bunch of readers that were Twilight fans. So it had the tipping point before it even became 50 Shades of Grey. So that's the first important thing about it becoming a mega success. But then the second thing was this thing about women being able to declare their sexuality just with the cover of a book. And I think that can't be underestimated.
Unfortunately, though, there were older women declaring their sexuality by reading a 20-something virgin.
Yeah. There's issues with that as well, that you can't read a book about an older woman having sex and say this is, you know, and hold your head high and go, this is, you know.
But the permission thing, book. I think, I agree with you.
It's a first step.
So I haven't read the book. I read some small bits of the book for a session we did actually a couple of years ago at the Brisbane Writers Festival on sex. Enough of it to know it's not very good. I've seen the film, however. So the sense I get is of a basically conventional romance narrative wrapped up with some S&M references, with a fairly predictable romantic fiction ending, certainly to the film. The film's not very good, but I do think it has some redeeming features that perhaps I'll touch on in a moment. But the one thing I'll say about the film is I didn't find it in the slightest bit erotic.
I don't think you were meant to.
No, okay.
I don't think it was made for
you. So that's
you.
Not the intention.
Yeah.
I don't think you were the target audience.
Okay. So I suppose my question is, did either of you find it an erotic film?
I reckon
there were
some scenes that were fairly hot.
Yep.
I remember that scene where Christian Grey's kind of crouching over the bed and there's a frontal shot of him kind of crawling across the bed and he's got his top off. And
sounds a bit like Twin Peaks to me, though.
but in its space and within its context, that's actually quite titillating. Mm-hmm. I know we make fun of him and, you know, all of that stuff, but if you put that aside and you just focus on what's being presented on the screen, that's pretty hot. It's not some gross, disgusting looking man like you see in a lot of porn crawling across the bed and, you know, claiming his territory.
Actually, I should, for the big ideas listeners who don't know the basic plot here, we're talking about a billionaire bachelor with a fetish for S&M. That's the creepy Mr. Grey, Christian. I think he's creepy anyway.
He is indeed creepy.
And he seduces the beautiful young, never-been-kissed-before, virginal college student, Anastasia, and henceforth takes her into his kinky world.
His red room of pain.
His red room of pain. Oh. Here's a question. Are we watching a film with kinky sex in it, or are we watching a film about abuse and violence?
Well, I think that kinky sex is very different from the kind of sex that's depicted in 50 Shades of Grey. I think that most of the people who are in the bondage and discipline community don't see themselves represented in that film. They see Christian Grey as presented as someone who is only into S&M because he was abused as a child, which is, you know, this narrative that we continuously tell ourselves so that we can kind of get over the idea, cope with the idea that people quite get off on hitting each other or tying each other up or doing other stuff to each other. So that's a problem because that's an abuse narrative which, you know, really shouldn't be at the centre of this book. There's also an issue that Anastasia is incredibly manipulative and she really pushes the boundaries of consent in terms of, you know, saying, yes, I will sign your contract, and then, no, I won't sign your contract. And she never signs a contract in the first, you know, book. And so we have this scene where there's a contract which would be a clear, I agree to this, I don't agree to this. And she's not even going to tell him what she agrees to. So she, you know, she reserves the right to manipulate him because she wants to change him.
That's true. But I saw that as her refusal to be subjugated.
My reading of the book is that she really wants to change him into...
I'm only talking about the film, by the way.
Yeah. A normal person.
A normal person. So stop him, break him from his kinky ways and bring him to the fold of normality. That's a narrative that we're sold again and again and again, that if you have a sexuality that is other than heterosexual monogamous, then suddenly you are a bad person. And this is the narrative that's sold to us in 50 Shades of Grey. So there is one of the problems that I have with both the book and the film, is that it's selling us a narrative which is fundamentally, I find distasteful and broken.
I found it a bit boring, quite boring, actually. I found the relationship unconvincing. I found the acting poor, and it was pretty poorly scripted. Production values were good.
Yeah.
But I did think, in its defence, that it had something to say about control and power within a relationship.
It tried to say something. It had an opportunity to really discuss submission in the way that perhaps, you know, Pauline Riage's story of O does, to really kind of nut out the reasons for, you know, dominance and submission. But this superficial attempt, it's almost like that's kind of put up there as a for its shock value. Or
we were talking about the final scene in the film and the spanking
that's
scene.
That's a massive problem.
Which is a real issue, because she agrees to be, she says, give it to me, show me what you've got. Give me, you know, show me what it's about. And then when he spanks her, she goes, oh, you're terrible, you're awful, I can't believe you did that to me, don't come near me. And it's like, no, actually, you could have said stop at any point in that, and there needs to be, we need to be, we don't need to be teaching young women that you need, that we're teaching the young women who are going to see this that no means yes and yes means no. You know, we need to be clearer about the fact that you actually have agency to say, I want to experience this sexual thing. I'm not enjoying this sexual experience. Stop it now. I don't like it. I changed my mind. And yet we're not giving women those signals. We're saying, if anyone spanks you, it's a bad thing, which is not the case. Lots of people enjoy that kind of play, and we're not giving that the space in the film.
So it's got an MA rating in Australia, which means anyone over the age of 15 can see it, which means that 15-year-old, I think, mostly girls, are going to see the film. Is it in any way opening up a conversation with that audience about any issues in a helpful way about sexuality?
No, I don't think so. My daughter, who's in the audience tonight, actually wanted to go and see it with her friends. And I'm pretty liberal with what I kind of give her permission to see and not see. She's got a room full of pornographic literature that she's able to access whenever she wants. But I felt really uncomfortable about the notion of her sitting there and watching it.
Why is that?
Because of those sort of problematic elements. Christian Grey is essentially kind of a stalker. He's
the sexual politics of the film, you
mean? Yeah, the sexual politics of the film. And because it plays into those normative expectations that, you know, a man is a provider, a woman is helpless and vulnerable without her man, she must change him because he's wounded, and, you know, all of those sorts of things. So I had a massive problem with her seeing that. And ultimately she could have gone to see it, but there would have had to be a discussion about the politics of the film. And it does concern me that the BDSM practices are totally misrepresented in the film, and that if she did kind of want to try something like that with her partner, that she would think that was the way to do it.
So how is it misrepresented?
In terms of consent, it's misrepresented. In terms of communication, there's no real clear and explicit and honest and authentic communication between Christian and Anastasia. She consents, then she withdraws consent, so no one really knows where they stand.
It's a good point, actually. But I thought that that was possibly because they were constructing Christian as a... a classic film villain.
Yeah, and that's a problem in itself, because not everyone who enjoys being a dominant is necessarily pathological or villainous.
Yeah.
They could be just a really cool guy.
Now, here's something that I bet you didn't know, or maybe you did, actually. Who am I to say that you wouldn't know a fact about sexual behaviour? Injuries caused by sex toys have doubled since 2007, with a particularly large increase in 2012 and 2013 after the release of 50 Shades of Grey. Now, If I'd had time to do some further research, I might have been able to find out precisely what those injuries were and the sex toys involved, but they are US figures. Someone's keeping a track on this sort of information.
It's good to know.
It's not surprising.
It's not surprising. One is that there's a whole bunch of really cheap sex toys that get pumped out that are 50 Shades of Grey sex toys, which are just not safe. And you really need to buy an expensive sex toy.
Because, go quality.
You know, go quality. You're putting that inside your body at times, or, you know, near your body at least, and you should actually go for a quality product. So there's one problem there. And the other problem is that people are thinking that they can just jump in and do BDSM without actually thinking it through and looking at safety and
educating
looking at,
you know,
and educating themselves about what really happens and what the injuries are that can occur. You know, not that every kind of book or, you know, film should come with a warning, don't try this at home, kiddie. It's like, that's a terrible thing. You should be able to try stuff at home. But I think that this kind of need to be swept up in the book of the moment and, you know, to kind of jump on the 50 Shades bandwagon and suddenly do S&M when you're not actually necessarily really interested in S&M practices. Mm. You're just following a trend. That's where a lot of problems can
occur. The other interesting thing was the film was released just at a time when this national conversation around domestic violence was really at its peak. And so I think that a lot of people went and saw that film through the prism of men abusing women. Mm. And perhaps that also coloured their views of the practices that that film purports to depict.
Mm. Yeah, there are just as many dominants in the BDS community who are women as there are who are men. So it's not a particularly gendered kink. It's something that both men and women enjoy. And again, that was
the book and the film do equate that to damage and violence, which is not the general consensus in the community. It's not about damaged people acting out their violence on someone else. It's not, that is not what it's about. And so that's where it's problematic.
Writer Chrissy Neen on Big Ideas on RN Online and on your pod. We're talking about sex, erotica and pornography, along with writer and academic Naomi Stakelenberg, who has just finished a PhD on the French writer and sexual libertine Marquis de Sade. So how on earth does one find themselves doing a doctorate on Marquis de Sade?
I chose Sade because I wanted to learn how to write transgressive sex, and I did a little bit of research and I figured out that Sade probably wrote the most transgressive sex that has ever been written. And so I thought I'd spend some time with him and figure out what he does and how he does it, and then use that knowledge to write my own transgressive sex.
Mm. So what interests you intellectually about Sade and his writing?
Well, of course, Sade regarded himself as a philosopher, so he didn't regard himself as a pornographer. And one of the things about his work that people usually don't know is that whilst he has scenes of really extreme sex, and, you know, there are orgies everywhere, and it's actually hard to kind of keep track of the characters because they're all just having sex with one another and we don't know who's where or what, and whatever. All of the sex scenes are punctuated by discourses on philosophy. So he regarded himself as a philosopher and a man of letters. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he uses the sex scenes in much the same way as Chrissy described. He uses them to create this kind of vulnerability in the reader. And at that point of vulnerability, he introduces ideas about atheism and ideas that are going to shock people and stun them. But I think they're so kind of beaten up by this, by the sex, that they're willing and open to accept new ideas.
He was writing when?
In the late 1700s.
Mm. Astonishing, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to some students yesterday and they were discussing about how kind of free we are to talk about sex now in contemporary society. And yeah, he was probably the most free. I mean, Apollinaire called him the most free spirit who ever lived way back then.
So there is an entire scholarship around erotic and transgressive literature, is there?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I was at a conference in Prague in October where a group of scholars got together and talked about sex fiction, so most of us weren't perverts.
You've, as part of your PhD, I think, certainly as one of the papers that you gave, written about conflict in sex fiction. This is the conflict between open sexual expression, saying it all, putting it all out there, and the constraint of disgust.
Yeah.
So in other words, if we say too much about a sex act, give too much information about certain things, about bodily functions and so on, this can turn titillation into repulsion. It's a fascinating idea. Can you talk to that a bit for us?
Okay, well, I write a lot about the ideas around hygiene and the exchange of pathogens in sex. So sex is essentially really, really dirty thing to do. If we kind of, semen's gross, spit, vaginal fluids, they're all something that we touch and we're exposed to in the act of sex. And it's something that no one really talks about. But I think it is something that we're aware of when we're discussing it. So even the very fact that I sat up here and talked about vaginal juices makes me a little bit disgusting. So I'm not showing them and I'm not kind of exposing my own and I'm not doing anything like that, but I mentioned the word and so suddenly I'm contaminated. And you are a little bit too. So I'm really fascinated by how sex is not only kind of dirty in the kind of abstract way, but dirty in the corporeal way, and how this impacts on our the ways we think about sex.
Is that perhaps why open discussion about sexual behaviour is so hard? Because at its core, it's dirty and sticky and messy.
Yeah, I think so. We can't help but think about the sexual act. We have to think about touching another's skin and catching germs. And in the moment of desire, of course, that all goes away. And in fact, touching someone else's skin or, you know, being exposed to their juices or whatever becomes a titillation. But disgust can also contain desire as well. So maybe the reason I'm not sitting up here fantasizing about having sex with you, Paul, is because disgust kind of keeps me tethered and it holds all that at bay and it contains it, because that would be disgusting. And so I don't cross that line.
Okay.
Okay.
Not necessarily, but disgusting to do it in front of all these people here tonight.
Okay.
Not having sex with you.
Oh, I knew we'd get into this sort of terrain tonight.
Here we go.
You're with Big Ideas on RN and online. Paul Barclay with you. Tonight we're discussing cultural representations and depictions of sex with writers Chrissy Neen and Naomi Stekelenburg. And a warning before we proceed any further. Some of you may find the subject matter we're about to discuss confronting and offensive. So, Chrissy, does this resonate with you, and your writing about sex, that if you go too far, it can be a turn-off?
I was exploring that in Triptych. That was exactly what I was doing. I was looking at boundaries. My boundaries of disgust are quite a lot higher than other people, I think. I quite like the fluids and the stickiness and the dirt involved. I'm a mud pit kind of girl.
Because it's the stuff you don't, certainly in films that are reasonably, I'm not talking about pornography, but mainstream films that are reasonably sexually explicit, the mess just never comes
into it. No, we don't know
never
the mess.
Even, never
and that's
seen
why it's sanitized. I'm often not turned on by mainstream films, and I'm not turned on by 50 Shades of Grey. It's all sanitized. I actually really quite like the idea of bodily fluids. I like the idea of skin on skin. I like the idea of smells and tastes and dirt. I think you can play in the dirt happily. And so I think that my line is a little bit further on. So with Triptych, I was really trying to push myself to find out what my lines were, what I wouldn't do, where my sense of disgust would kick in, which, you know, is a little bit further down the track to your average reader. And so I was really interested to find out where readers would draw the line in terms of my
Because you have to have the reader in mind, obviously. You don't want to write a book that people actually have to stop reading because you've gone too far over the line.
Yeah, exactly. So there was... And for that reason, Triptych is full of very beautiful people. Like, I didn't explore... my main characters are physically what you would consider, socially acceptable in their beauty, because I didn't want to push it on all fronts in this particular book, because I wanted to push it in terms of the perversities that I was looking at.
And your scenes of bestiality are almost like love scenes, aren't they?
I wanted it to be about love. Yeah. I wanted this book to be the most romantic book I ever wrote. So, in fact, the bestiality novella is probably the most romantic thing I will ever write in my life.
So, how so?
They fall in love. It's all about a woman who falls in love with her best friend, the girl's best friend. It happens to be her dog. And that the dog falls in love with her. And it's about a traditional monogamous relationship. And she's challenged on that when her friend, who is also interested in animals, kind of comes into her territory and is interested in her dog, her lover, her best friend. But then there, of course, there's a situation where humans outlive their pets, and so she outlives her lover, and then what happens in that kind of period of grief? And she turns to other beasts, because that she basically is a zoophile and is only interested in animals. So for me, it was really about, it was about love and loss and grief, and I wanted to kind of structure it as a typical and traditional love story. Like, I wanted love to be very focused and central, so that we could get over our disgust of the fact that we actually have half the characters being, you know, from the farmyard.
At the basically. Same time, you've said that you like to make people feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
About.
Yeah,
this.
And that,
you like to take
yes.
them to an uncomfortable place,
yes.
which is obviously love, notwithstanding what you're doing with this story.
Absolutely.
Taking people to an uncomfortable place.
Absolutely. And I wanted to take them to that uncomfortable place so that at some point in the reading of that story, they would stop and go, hang on, I'm being aroused by something that will normally repel me. Therefore, where was my line? And I kind of wanted the reader to be like, you know, like a crab in hot water, or, you know, put them in the water when it's cold and then turn the heat up really, really slowly. So your reader's in the pot and, you know, the heat's going up and up and up and it's getting hotter and hotter. And sooner or later they're going, I think
they're
it's
screaming.
Too hot for me, but I don't know where that happened because I was overwhelmed by lust. And that was my intention, to make the reader into an ethical reader,
yeah.
and to question their lines and to make that line really blurry. When did it become too much for that reader? And I wanted them to stop reading and go, hang on, where am I? I'm out of my depth. And where is that line?
Where does this come from? Is, and how much of your writing is you rummaging through the dark and transgressive fantasies of your mind, saying the unsayable? And how much of it is just constructed in a way a novelist will construct and make up anything? How much of it is you? How much of it is just not quite you?
At this stage, there's probably less and less of me as I go on. When I started writing, because I started, you know, with a memoir, so I started with the truth and my own sexuality and being honest about that. And then as I move further and further into fiction, I'm more and more interested in ideas and concepts that remove it from my own personal experience. But in the memoir that I first put out, I was laying that out of going, okay, I've done all this stuff. This is what I've done. And giving myself permission to kind of work from there, from all those things that I'd done sexually. And I did them sexually because sex was a banned subject when I was a child. I, you know, received books that had chapters and paragraphs cut out of them because there was kissing in them.
Cut out of them by your parents?
Cut out of them by my family. I was raised by my grandmother, and she didn't like any kind of sign of sexuality to be around in the house. We'd, you know, when we did have we didn't have television as such, but we had movies, and so if there was kissing in the movie, she'd, you know, turn it off. Because
kissing,
passionate kissing. They could kiss on the cheek, but okay. You know, pretty much there was a line, and when the tongue was involved, it was all over. So the lines were really, really strict with her. And so when I was, you know, allowed to read literature, the literature would have to be censored before I got it. So I came to sexuality as a naive character, as one of Saad's naive women, not understanding what I should like and what I shouldn't like. So I kind of came into the world of sexuality going, let's just try it all and see what I like and what I don't. So the world was really open to me when I left home because, you know, there was no more boundaries, and I'd had such total boundaries that then I wanted to try everything and find out what it was all about, the whole messy world of sexuality. And I'm still exploring that.
I think, given the context you've just put it in, understandable. Something has been denied you, so you go on this quest to discover what it is that you've not been allowed to experience. I completely get that. You didn't have to write an explicit sexual memoir about it for the whole world to read, though. I mean, that's a big leap, isn't it? And what gave you the courage to expose yourself, to reveal yourself in that way?
I didn't actually think it through when I was putting it out in the world. I knew that my sex scenes, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I'd been writing serious literary fiction and, you know, almost getting published and not quite. And I knew that people responded
most of the sex scenes in the book, and mostly people were commenting on how strong the sex scenes were. And people were interested in my own story. They'd ask me, how can you write that sex scene from a man's perspective? And I could say, oh, well, you know, I've had these interesting sexual experiences where I've been with, you know, two men, and I've been, you know, watching, I've been a first-hand observer of that kind of sexuality. And people were fascinated, and they wanted to hear more. And so as a writer, I knew that this was an area that actually would be read, would be, you know, people would be interested in reading this. And so I treated it as any other writing project. I wrote the scenes as they were in my life, and then I worked at structure and looked at expression and looked at language and treated it at a remove from myself. So even though I'd put all the real scenes down on the page, I was thinking of Chrissy as a character, not as myself.
Oh, that's
as I was editing it into a book. And it wasn't really until I got to the other end of the process and it was out in the world that I kind of went, oh yeah, everyone knows how I like to have sex now, you know. And then it was kind of like, you know, there's a little bit of discomfort in that because people are looking at you in a different way. But I think that it's okay to be open about your sexuality because it allows other people to go, I'm okay, I'm a bit kinky, I'm a bit weird, and that's okay.
Before we came here tonight, we were having a bit of a chat beforehand and just discussing what we were going to talk about. And I think I confessed to you that when I read a novel that I'm enjoying by a writer that I like, and the obligatory sex scene comes along, I frequently just peel through the next few pages because they're so bad. I mean, even gifted novelists have this propensity to write really bad sex scenes. So I was going to ask you the question, on the whole, how do you find sexual depictions in literary fiction by established decent writers of literature? Do you have a similar sense that I do?
I think the ones who do it the best are the ones who are able to emphasise the sensuality of the experience. So the ability to move into that sensual space and focus on kind of all the things that happen to you sensually when you have sex are the really good erotic fiction writers, like Anais Nin, for instance. Yep. I think she does this superbly. And even Saad, to some extent, even though he's a bit of a kind of...
Yep.
There's he's also not quite as gentle as...
James Salter is my sex god in terms of literature. He's a very, very well-regarded literary fiction author, and his book, A Sport and a Pastime, is, you know, a pornographic text. It's absolutely gorgeous. And he manages somehow, he's an expert at this, he manages to show both the beauty and the passion and the wonder of sex, and then in the next paragraph there's an awkwardness, or someone's, you know, slipping off the bed, or someone's, you know, got bad breath. There's kind of that humanity that he manages to put in there that we all experience during sex. It's not one great big wonderful romantic romp when we're in bed together, you know, your teeth click and someone farts in the wrong place. It's just like
this is the other thing we were talking about, wasn't it, that there's bad sex writing and then there's writing about bad sex.
Yes.
And I think I said to you that I found in Andrew McGann's book Praise there was lots of good writing about bad sex, about exactly what you said, that sort of awkwardness that everybody has experienced and understands.
And it's very important to put that stuff out there because, you know, that is the real experience of sexuality. We are uncomfortable bodies coming together and trying to learn how they fit together, specifically new partners. I mean, partners that have been together for a long time figure out where that leg goes and, you know, and that then it becomes a bit routine. But, you know, new partners, there's a lot of awkwardness and there's a lot of, you know, gaffes that happen. And it's funny. Sex is actually funny. Like, if you don't laugh during sex, I'm not sure what you're doing, like you're acting, because it's hilarious.
Naomi mentioned before the importance of erotica being, in a sense, consumed for its own sake, for the pleasure of just being in that moment and appreciating how joyous and wonderful it is. I wanted to talk about the opposite of that, when writing about sex is not writing about sex at all, when it's about something different, when it's perhaps about relationships or power or I don't know. And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about Bertolucci's film Last Tango in Paris and the sexual politics that play out in that film between the Brando character and the Maria Schneider character. Are you conscious that sometimes when you're writing about sex, you're not writing about sex? You're writing about something else?
You're always not writing about sex.
Yeah,
you're always
writing
about politics or society or psychology. I mean, I don't think you can separate. We try to. We'd like to think that we can. But I don't think we can separate our sexual lives from other aspects of our existence.
Which is probably why reading some of the erotic classics today, there are some people who have problems with some of the sexual politics in the work, or some of the kind of the political kind of surroundings of the work. And it's because we're translating it to a modern day. And I think that reading a book in the context of when it was written, that completely changes the meaning of the book and how you read it. I think Naomi's absolutely right that it's kind of, you can't ever separate it from the world in which it's written and the audience that it's written to and the kind of society that it's written for.
Is it harder to write erotica in an era where pornography is so widely available and where the limits to the imagination are far less than they were back when Anais Nin and so on was writing?
It's easier to research. You can just, Google,
you can get your ideas from
sex and it's there on the internet.
That's where most of the ideas come from. I think we're working with a different medium. We're working with words when we write. So, no. I think there's a huge difference between watching something on the screen and reading.
The trajectory of literature has not been quite as steep as the trajectory of visual images, really. And
we still live in a very textual world, though. Like, I don't think the proliferation.
It is a hard word, isn't it?
of porn has altered our capacity to write sex.
Chrissy, you've got a new book coming out.
We do.
The Adventures of Holly White and the Incredible Sex Machine.
Yes.
It's coming out in a month or two, is that right?
Yeah, it's coming out on the 22nd of April.
Tell us what it's about.
It's about a woman who goes from innocence to experience within the context of the book, but she has this secret. She has a vagina that glows blue. And basically she's frightened of this. She takes a vow of
abstinence. The same blue as your hair, perhaps?
The same blue as my hair, in fact. That's probably styled on it. But she has this vow of abstinence that she takes with her friends. And that's to mainly because she's afraid of her own sexuality. But she joins a book club, and the book club start to read the classics of erotic fiction. And as she reads the classics of erotic fiction, the power of the sexuality within her increases to a point where she needs to go on a personal journey to discover her own sexual power. And it touches on the work of Wilhelm Reich, who was the inventor of orgone energy, and orgone energy was the energy that is expressed through orgasm. It's been referenced in so many popular culture references. Devo's hats were orgone accumulators to gather the orgone energy. Kate Bush, her cloud busting video was about an orgone energy reverse accumulator.
There was a moment when we pondered wearing Devo hats tonight.
I know, we really should have brought them, I think. But yeah, it's like Wilhelm Reich's work was quite startling and funny and fun, and he was a big figure of the sexual revolution. And a lot of people had these orgone accumulators that he built in their houses. So William Burroughs had one, Germaine Greer had one. You know, they're like big figures had these orgone accumulators. And
What precisely do the orgone accumulators do?
They gather the sexual energy and they channel it and focus it. I have never been in one, apart from my plastic Devo hat. But
is that a bit like, remember when the idea of sitting underneath a pyramid had its moment in the sun?
And very similar, yes. It's all that energy work. And look, some people really believe that this is true. For me, that wasn't important whether it was true or not. For me, it was just a really great, fun idea to explore the idea. Mm. The idea that books, like classic erotic books, are like batteries. You know, they're inert. And then when you need someone to read them before their energy is kind of, you know, brought out from the book. So, you know, it really, Wilhelm Reich was onto something. Mm. You know, these works like Sard is a whole bunch of power there in the book, which is doing nothing until someone reads it and is scandalised by it, and then the power is out.
And Chrissy Neen's book, Holly White and the Incredible Sex Machine, will be released in a little over a week's time by Text Publishing. Our other guest tonight was Naomi Stakelenburg, writer and academic. That chat was recorded at Avid Reader a few weeks ago. You've been listening to Big Ideas here on RN. You can tell us what you think about the issues raised in tonight's discussion online at abc.net.au/RN, or you can tweet us at RN Big Ideas. Thanks for your time. Bye for now.
It may be lonely at the top, but for decades the US has enjoyed worldwide influence, the power to create political and economic order virtually anywhere. But is Washington's power fading?
Anyone who tells you otherwise, anyone who tells you that America is in decline or that our influence has waned, doesn't know what they're talking about.
Leading Harvard intellectual Stephen Walt disagrees. That's Between the Lines with me, Tom Switzer, online at the RN homepage.